The Guardian.
Our lives have changed beyond recognition in a very short space of time. It's like dropping a pebble in a pond, and the ramifications of it are so huge.
When I was working, it was also you had that fallback of your mates in the pub with a couple of beers after work, you know, which was good. Well, you know, just socialising, stuff like that. So, you know, so all that's gone for me now. Driving, cycling, you know, I fell off my bike, running, I fell over when I was out running one day as well. So, you know, sort of, if you can go wrong, you can go wrong.
You know, this is a man who had everything going for him just under 5 years ago. You know, he was working in the city, had a lovely job, good salary, loads of friends, and that was taken away from him in an instant.
Hello, my name is Roger. I was diagnosed with Huntington's disease about 4 years ago, and I'm currently under the care of Ed Wild at the Neurology Centre in London.
My name's Ed Wild. I'm a consultant neurologist and a principal investigator at University College London Huntington's Disease Centre.
My name's Brenda, and I'm Roger's wife.
And I'm Hannah Devlin. This week, Huntington's disease, an illness that has no cure and, as you've heard, has devastating impacts on those affected.
Yeah, Huntington's is a neurodegenerative illness, so it belongs to the same family of diseases as Alzheimer's or Parkinson's, in that the brain cells or neurons malfunction and die more quickly than they should. And all of this progresses quite slowly but inexorably over about 15 to 20 years, and unfortunately it's always fatal. And so everyone who is diagnosed will eventually pass away because of Huntington's.
This disease has a few strange genetic quirks that has made scientists wonder whether the genetic flaw might also have some benefits.
It is pretty well studied that people who have adult onset HD when they are younger are generally more robust than their unaffected siblings. They don't get sick as much. People with the HD mutation have substantial protection from cancer. So there are a number of ways that there is still an evolutionary advantage to having HD.
Twenty-five years after the discovery of the Huntington gene, we look at its history, its importance, and why it can sometimes be a double-edged sword. This is Science Weekly. Huntington's disease, or HD, is genetic. That means you can't catch it. It's written into the DNA instructions you inherit from your mother or father. And Dr. Ed Wild thinks this is one of the many things that makes the illness so horrible.
One of the most unpleasant things about it is that it's a genetic illness. So it runs in families, and everyone who has Huntington's disease has a 50-50 risk of passing it on to each of their children. So if your parent had Huntington's, you've got a heads or tails kind of chance that you will inherit the mutation. If you inherit that mutation, it means you'll definitely get Huntington's at some point.
And when does it normally present? When do the symptoms first emerge?
It tends to come on in early to mid-adult life, so much earlier than typical cases of Alzheimer's or Parkinson's. So people are often in their 30s or 40s when they get the symptoms. In the prime of life, the peak of their working career, time when they want to be raising families and really enjoying life, that's when Huntington's will often strike.
Roger was diagnosed in his 50s.
It was about 4 years ago. I was at work, you know, just doing my normal job, working in the city as an insurance broker. And my boss called me to one side and said, I've had a couple of phone calls, Rog, people saying that you're not yourself. So I sort of came home, mentioned it to my wife, and she said, well, what sort of things have they been mentioning about? And they said my eyes were rolling. And so Brenda thought, well, that was probably, you know, a sign that I had illness as well, because my sister had it. both of my sisters have got the illness. So I went down to our local doctor and they basically confirmed the diagnosis with, I can't remember the technical term, but it takes a month to come through for the final diagnosis, yeah.
It's called a positive result, but really it's a very negative result. Yeah, so, yeah. And obviously we realised at that point that our kids were at risk as well, and we had no chance of doing anything to prevent them being at risk. So that's where we are at the moment, and I live every day with the guilt of having them, even though I wasn't in a position to have done anything about it at the time. But it's a horrible thing for them to have to live with. You know, they're 29 and 26 now, and it's just very, very difficult.
Yeah, that's one of the, what Ed was saying, it's just one of the cruel things about the illness is the way it affects whole families,
that's
isn't it?
Yeah.
And you've mentioned that you'd already had children before Roger was diagnosed. How have your children dealt with this, and have they decided to get tested, or do they prefer to just get on with their lives?
My daughter wavers between testing and not testing. However, she has gone on to have an HD-free baby, but she still wavers between being tested because they're sort of thinking about having another baby, which would mean going through the same route again. I don't think you could have one that you knew was excluded and then go on to have another which was possibly at risk. So I think the idea's always churning over in her mind. But our son says there's absolutely no way he would ever be tested, because if he knew that he carried the gene, he couldn't live with it and would kill himself. And that's a terrible thing for a 26-year-old to have to be contemplating.
And Roger, at the moment, how has your illness affected your day-to-day life?
I'm a lot better now. Because I think when I was first diagnosed, the thought of coming up and doing something like this, but I just said no. So I suppose I've got used to my illness, what it's going to bring me in the future. And I guess probably helping out with research with Ed and the team there. Sort of like keeps me involved and sort of doesn't quite give me something to do, but it does. It's probably a denigrating thing a little bit, but yeah.
Roger and Brenda have both helped with various research projects to try and find a treatment, including one where they donated their spinal fluid so doctors like Ed can understand how one faulty gene can cause so much damage.
Roger was one of the people who gave spinal fluid in the first ever lot of collections that we did. It's because of people doing that kind of stuff that really moves us forward as a community, and actually the involved drugs at all, but it helps us understand the disease. And that was how we were able to develop.
Since the Huntington's gene was discovered 25 years ago, scientists are slowly beginning to understand. This gene holds a set of instructions to make a protein called Huntington.
What we know about Huntington protein is that it's complicated. It's a huge protein. It's one of the biggest proteins in the body. And we know it does stuff, okay? So proteins are these molecular machines that do stuff. And Huntington, we know a lot of things that it's involved in, but it's very difficult to figure out exactly how. So it's very important for the development of the nervous system. We know that. Inside our neurons, it's involved in the switching on and off of genes. It's involved in trafficking things around the cells. It's involved in communication between cells. And we know that if you genetically...
The way the gene makes this multitasking protein is with a set of instructions. In genes, these instructions come in the form of a series of four letters strung together. A, C, G, T. In Huntington's, there are too many repetitions of a set of letters, a stutter. And as a result, the protein comes out all wrong.
The gene in our DNA that's the recipe for the Huntington protein is slightly unusual in that towards the beginning of that gene, there's a sequence of three letters, CAG, that we all have, that's repeated a number of times. And in someone who's going to get Huntington's disease, there's 40 or more. So there are too many instances of CAG at the beginning of the gene. And each of those three letters tells the cell to add a building block called glutamine to the Huntington protein. So in someone with the HD mutation, they end up with too many glutamine building blocks at the beginning of their Huntington protein. And for reasons that we don't fully understand, that makes their protein poisonous. It becomes harmful. So we call it the mutant Huntington protein. And it can still do some of the good stuff in neurons, as far as we can tell, but it takes on this dark side where it starts to harm neurons. It sticks to itself, it sticks to other proteins, and it gets into the nucleus of the cell, and it messes up the switching on and off of other genes, and it causes a really wide range of disturbances in the neurons.
There are some brain cells or neurons that are especially affected, and these sit in a region called the basal ganglia. It's right in the middle of your head, at the base of your brain. It's responsible for controlling movements, but also cognitive processes like memory, planning, and problem solving. But there's more to the Huntington's gene and the number of CAG repeats than meets the eye. And it's these quirks that have got scientists wondering whether this stutter could be beneficial in other ways.
The CAG arose in the Huntington gene around the time that primitive nervous systems were evolving. And it co-evolved, that CAG repeat, co-evolved with more and more sophisticated brains.
Could these repeats be responsible for our big brains? Could Huntington's be an unfortunate offshoot of our intelligence? I'll be back in a moment after the ad break.
Kibera in Nairobi in Kenya is the biggest slum in Africa and one of the biggest in the world. And that makes it one of the more surprising settings for a ballet school.
I want to work with children to see if I can make a difference through dance. If I can just use myself as a tool to transform children's lives in the informal settlements.
Join me, Lucy Lamble, for this week's episode of Small Changes. I chat to one dance teacher who's made it his life's work to provide underprivileged children in Kenya with an education that isn't always afforded to them by the government. Just head over to theguardian.com/podcasts or search Small Changes on your favourite podcast app.
Welcome back to Science Weekly. I'm Hannah Devlin. Before the break, we looked at Huntington's disease and how too many repeats of CAG within a gene causes the illness. But why do we have this stutter in our DNA code? Could it be that it helped create complex nervous systems and therefore our intelligence?
Hello.
Hi, Amber. It's Greya from The Guardian. How are you?
Oh, good. How are you?
Yeah, good. We were just having a few.
Our producer, Greya, spoke to Amber Southwell.
I'm an assistant professor of neuroscience at the University of Central Florida's Burnett School of Biomedical Sciences.
Can you just talk me through what...
Greya wanted to know more about these CAG repeats.
So Huntington's disease is a CAG repeat expansion disorder. So it means the DNA letters CAG, 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 that stretch of CAGs is called a tract. And the length of that tract can determine health or disease.
If you have 35 or below, you won't develop Huntington's. For those with 36 to 40 CAG repeats,
they may or may not ever develop Huntington's. So people who have 36, 37,
40 and above CAG repeats, then you'll definitely develop the disease. However, as you get higher and higher, the earlier in life you'll get it. If you hit 60 CAG repeats,
people get sick before they're 20 years old, sometimes as small children, depending on how long that repeat is. So there are some other things that contribute to age of onset. The actual CAG tract length is only responsible for about 50 to 70% of the variation. And the rest is environmental and genetic factors, some known, some unknown. But sometimes the predicted age of onset, it can be plus or minus 20 years. So there's a lot of people who are working on trying to figure out what those genetic and environmental factors are to push people towards the later part of that potential onset age range.
The number of repeats is unstable across generations, though, and can increase in offspring. The more CAG repeats you have, the more likely that is. So even though you may be in the safe zone, your kids may not. This is what Amber calls slippage.
Because we have, as humans, such long CAG tracts, it makes it more difficult for it to make that CAG tract perfect. And so there's slippage.
Why is there a tendency for CAG repeats to increase across generations? The evolution of this repeat is something Elena Cattaneo from the University of Milan has been looking into. Elena has found that the Huntington gene first evolved in a type of soil-living organism commonly referred to as slime mold. It had no CAG repeats. Then there were two repeats in sea urchins, and then more and more and more as more complex life develops. Here's Amber again.
The CAG arose in the Huntington gene around the time that primitive nervous systems were evolving. And it co-evolved, that CAG repeat co-evolved with more and more sophisticated brains. So the more complex the brain, the longer the CAG tract.
For instance, there's 7 in mice, dogs have 10, and the rhesus monkeys have around 15. And some studies have shown that there may be benefits to having more repeats.
It is pretty well studied that people who have adult onset HD when they are younger are generally more robust than their unaffected siblings. They don't get sick as much. They have more children. People with the HD mutation have substantial protection from cancer. So there are a number of ways that there is still an evolutionary advantage to having HD, because typically onset happens after the years of childbearing.
In fact, one study found that people with higher numbers of CAG repeats also have more gray matter in the brain.
So one of the studies was an MRI study in normal people, people with no HD mutation, and it was found that the people who had the high normal CAG tract lengths had more gray matter. Now, having more gray matter does not necessarily mean that you're smarter or more evolved or anything. We're not really sure what that means, but it is interesting.
What is grey matter an indicator of? You said it was interesting, but why is it interesting that there's more grey matter?
So the grey matter is composed of the neurons. The white matter in the brain is the connections, the connectivity between neurons. So grey matter, having more grey matter, could potentially mean you have more neurons, more brain cells. So that could potentially mean that you have the capacity for more processing. It doesn't necessarily mean that, because connectivity is as important as having the neurons to do it. We can maybe say having gray matter means you might have a greater capacity for thought and processing. But it doesn't necessarily mean that. Again, it's not absolute.
So could it be one of the driving forces behind the evolution of our big brains? And could it be the price humanity pays for intelligence? Amber was quick to point out that correlation does not mean causation.
Well, correlation and causation, you can't really, we can say that the expansion of the CAG tract co-evolved with a more complicated brain, and that the Huntington gene, the Huntington protein, is required to make a brain, but it's a bit of a leap to say that the expansion of the CAG tract is the reason for making more complex brains. We can maybe surmise that, but we can't know that.
I also asked Ed what he thought about the role of CAG repeats.
Yeah, the whole CAG in the Huntington gene thing is absolutely fascinating, because it's very clear that having a Huntington gene is super important, and having CAGs in that gene lets us get to where we are now with this deluxe human brain that we have. And if you look at cells in a dish, even in the normal CAG range, if you have slightly more CAG repeats, those cells process energy more efficiently. And there's been some reports that even if you expand the number of CAGs into the range that could later cause Huntington's disease, there might be some benefits in life relating to risk of cancer or relating to intellectual development. Those things are actually surprisingly difficult to study in real-life humans. And so the numbers of people that we've actually been able to study have been small. And I think what we have is this fascinating gene with this really interesting ingredient. It's very clear that at some point, too much of a good thing produces a situation that's very harmful for the brain. So whether on the way to that bad thing happening, there's some sort of temporary or survival advantage that might have had its impact echoing back through human genetic history, I think we don't know at the moment, but we've got some really fascinating theories, and people are starting to develop the huge data sets that would be necessary to study those issues definitively.
From what both Amber and Ed have said, it seems like more research is going to be needed before we can say for sure if we can thank CAG repeats for our big brains. Either way, the Huntington protein is important in brain development and learning. So the question becomes, can we keep some of the CAG repeats, but not all of them? Hope may be on the horizon. Dr. Ed Wild is part of a team that is trialling a way to stop the Huntington protein being made.
Yeah, so the DNA is very difficult to interact with directly. And the protein is big and complicated and, for separate reasons, very difficult to interact with. But in the middle, between the DNA and the protein, is this message molecule. It's kind of like a working photocopy of the gene, messenger RNA. But whenever the cell is making a protein, it'll produce thousands of these RNA molecules, and each of those is then used as a template, really, for building the protein. And that stuff just floats around in the nucleus and cytoplasm and is relatively easy to interact with. It's not defended like the DNA. So what you can actually do is make a drug so that it would stick to the RNA molecule, the message molecule that comes from the Huntington gene, but it wouldn't stick to the message molecule from any other gene. So you're shooting the messenger. And this whole sort of family of techniques is known as gene silencing, or perhaps targeted protein lowering. It sounds straightforward, and it's a relatively straightforward approach. You're basically, your house is flooding, you want to turn off the tap. But it's taken a long time to get lots and lots of researchers up to this point. And our involvement at the UCLHD Center has been that we were the lead center for the first ever human trial of a Huntington lowering drug that uses this DNA technology. And the trial took about 2 years, and in December, we were able to announce that for the first time ever, we had successfully lowered the concentration of the mutant protein. We don't yet know whether that will translate into clinical benefit, because it was a very short trial. Each person was only in the trial for 4 months. But we have reason to believe that this is a big step forward, because we know this protein causes the disease, and it's the first time that the cause of Huntington's disease has successfully been squashed.
Brenda and Roger, this kind of work must, you know, Ed said it is in an early stage, and we've still not got the proof that it definitely is going to change clinical outcomes, but it must give you some hope to see that there are possible treatments on the horizon now for this illness.
It certainly does. Roger has already participated in an unsuccessful clinical trial of a previous drug. He was on a drug called Lequinimod for a year. And, you know, we'll do anything that we can to help along with research. But this one just seems to be something that seems to be working. You know, I was saying to Ed earlier that I actually try and shy away from the news because you get so much false hope. So I try not to get too overexcited, but I'd love to get Roger on this drug.
Yeah, I think Brenda volunteered me before myself for the last trial. So, I mean, obviously, you know, that's amazing news. And I think they said it's the biggest news in 50 years of the illness. So, yeah, so fingers crossed.
This is a disease that affects around 6,000 people in the UK and many more across the world. And that's what makes breakthroughs like these especially important. Many thanks to Brenda, Roger, Ed Wilde and Amber Southwell for making the time to be interviewed this week. You can find links to their work and anything else you've heard on the podcast on our website, theguardian.com/podcasts. On there, you'll also find our email address should you want to reach out to the team. I'm Hannah Devlin, this is Science Weekly, and until next time, goodbye.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.